God grant that something I say may be of some use to somebody. Amen. Jesus said, "The day is coming when true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth." Well, thank you for the invitation to speak tonight in this series of Lent addresses. And it's a joy to be here in this splendid church and with such beautiful music. And also lovely to see Vaughan and Amanda Gaines, we were colleagues together in Bath. A year ago, my sister was having a party to celebrate her birthday. And as soon as I entered the room, a lady accosted me and said, "How can you spend all your time talking to Muslims? You ought to be converting them." Well, I don't quite see how you convert people without talking to them, but that's by the by. So I asked her, "How many Muslims do you actually know?" Well, she didn't know any, but she had a friend who knew someone who had a Muslim living next door. Well, what about Jesus' conversation with the woman of Samaria? I wonder whether any of his disciples had ever actually spoken to somebody who was a Samaritan. That division. And I guess they were equally shocked, or as John puts it rather more tactfully, were greatly surprised to find Jesus with no chaperone talking to a woman. And worse, the woman was a Samaritan, and as John points out, Jews and Samaritans would never use the same cups and bowls. Now, conversation cannot solve all our problems, but it can help to break down barriers. And I think it's always a warning sign that there's trouble in a marriage when husband and wife stop talking to each other. Religions in conversation. I'm sure you've spotted a problem with the title. Religions don't speak to each other, but people who claim to be religious may do so. And of course, each conversation is individual. But I hope by some sharing some conversations which I've had with people of other faiths, this may give you a taste for interfaith dialogue, and some of you will be already taking part in it, and encourage you to be more adventurous. As our society has become more multi-faith, most of us will have had conversations with people of other faiths. Our local garage is owned by a Muslim friend who has now become an imam, so we spend more time talking about religion than the price of petrol. And most hospitals are mini United Nations. So such conversations should be natural and taken for granted. A structured conversation, or what perhaps rather grandly is called interfaith dialogue, happens at many levels. And I thought I might summarize it under five headlines. The negative, opposing the misuse of religion to justify violence and to cause division. Building social cohesion. Faiths acting together for a better world. Theological discussion and spiritual sharing. The first dimension, which I call the negative, involves countering prejudice, especially anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. It's dispelling ignorance and witnessing together against the misuse of religion to foster hatred and justify violence. And it can really be quite simple. I remember Mary asking a woman at the checkout who was from Afghanistan whether she liked being in England. The woman replied, "No, no one talks to me, and it's always raining." But even those little conversations, can somehow begin to break down difficulties. And it's not always easy to get people to talk to each other. And I think back to a reception some years ago that Mary and I were asked to in Jerusalem. And I was talking to a rabbi who I'd known in London, and Mary was talking to a Palestinian lady. And those, you know, sometimes those sort of parties, we turn together. And Mary introduced the Palestinian lady, I introduced the rabbi, and they then walked to opposite sides of the room. That's lack of conversation. And of course, in Korea, for many years, it's a place we've been to two or three times, was still divided, 50, 60 years. For many years, it was an offense, whether you were North Korean or South Korean, to contact or try to contact relatives on the other side of a demilitarized line. And I remember talking to one person who spent several years in prison, South Korean, for just trying to contact his brother. But by inviting people from both parts of Korea to an interfaith conference in another country, we allowed some contact to be established. And I also knew of a North Korean who was living in the United States, who was allowed to go back to North Korea to film. And he took as many pictures as possible of ordinary people. And the films were then shown on television in South Korea, and several people for the first time saw pictures of their relations who they hadn't been in touch with for 50 or 60 years. So don't despise just meeting, because there are so many barriers and divisions. Don't despise what has been called tea and chat. Encouraging people from many standpoints to meet and talk remains a vital part of the educational work of interfaith organizations. And perhaps one of the most moving occasions, when at the International Interfaith Center in Oxford, we had two people from Cyprus, a Turkish Cypriot and a Greek Cypriot. We managed to get them together, but they were sitting at the very furthest end of the table, as far apart as possible. And for something like 20 minutes, each of them, when they spoke, it was a litany of complaint against the other. Somehow the mood changed, and one of them said, well, of course, we do want peace. And the other echoed it. And then by the end, they said, well, I'll go home and tell my friends that there are people the other side who want peace. And such conversations are not easy. But healing the wounds of conflict is part of the interfaith agenda. But it's risky. It's costly. Can we face the truth about ourselves, the failures of our church, the imperialism of our history? We all need to forgive and to be forgiven. We don't know where a conversation will lead, but it will lead nowhere if it's not begun by each of us as well as by religious leaders. So trying just to remove the ignorance and the prejudice. Then secondly, social cohesion, which is perhaps a slightly more positive response to the fact of divisions. A friend of mine who was a devout Christian told a colleague at work that her daughter was very ill. During the weekend, the colleague rang up to ask how the girl was and added, we've been praying for her. Now, her colleague was a Hindu. And so my Christian friend said it was the first time it made her wonder. Is there one God? Will the Hindu God hear the prayers for her Christian child? It made her reflect. And so easily we haven't begun to do this. Now, a lot is being done in Britain at all levels to bring people of different faiths together. But it saddens me that even those who go to interfaith activities all too seldom ask friends into their own home. And what is the reaction of the families and the faith community if a girl of one religion wants to marry a boy who belongs to another religion? There are real problems, and this is part of a dynamic of trying to learn to live together. And so easily, religion becomes a badge of identity. You know, what we wear, what we don't eat, the divisions, and it creates barriers between people. Jews and Samaritans wouldn't share a cup. And some of you will have been, perhaps, in India. And I went there, when I first went there, although technically illegal, the caste system at least was still concerned. And very clear whether people would use the same china, or in the villages where outcasts have to go to a separate well. These divisions are all too real and all too painful. And these divisions can be reinforced by an exclusive claim to a monopoly of God's truth and love. And slowly, people of many faiths are recognizing that there is one God who made each one of us in the divine image. God is love, and God embraceth every child of every race. Jesus himself said to the woman of Samaria at the well, the time would come when people would not worship God on Mount Gerizim, which was where the Samaritans worshipped, or in Jerusalem. Instead, true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And social cohesion requires more than learning about other religions, interaction and working with people of different faiths is essential. And let me give as an example a program of the Free Faiths Forum. It's called the Parliament Mentoring Program. Each year, 45 students of politics in groups of three, these are undergraduates, in groups of three, one Jewish, one Christian, one Muslim, are mentored by a member of parliament, and they do a project together. And so by talking and working together, the members of each group form deep bonds, but also the young people are helped to feel part of British society. Because so often government seems aloof, and young people feel they have no stake in it. And it's also really good for the MPs to have conversations and to listen to some young people. And several of them have said what important part of their life work this has been. And then thirdly, faiths acting together. And there are a whole range of topics, such as peace building, development, human rights, the environment, on which faith communities are in Britain are talking and working together, locally, nationally, and internationally. And this positive work often hardly gets a mention. But during Interfaith Week last November, I was particularly impressed going to a meeting at the Muslim College in Ealing, arranged by some Muslims who were particularly campaigning to stop the trade in sex slaves, but trying really to campaign for greater acceptance of women's rights in every community. And we were there, Sikh and Hindu and Jewish and Christian speakers. That sort of concern. And more Muslim communities taking initiatives in interfaith events. Or another example, in 2009, the Parliament of World Religions, Mary, my wife, led a session on the spiritual needs of older people. And we had chaplains to hospices from several religions who were working, who shared their experiences. And we can learn from each other. And I remember once when we were having a meeting about hospices, one of the imams came, something he'd never sort of heard about before, and really made him reflect on the care that his community offered. And then meetings we've heard in the House of Parliament about reconciliations, really the healing after conflict. What can people say of Rwanda or Bosnia by sharing their experience help to heal those wounds? And another occasion of United Nations, we were trying to create a greater link between the faith communities and the social and health work of United Nations, trying to see how there could be a greater partnership. And it's important because more than half the healthcare and educational provision in the world is by faith communities. So it was really important that the United Nations, people involved in the same work, should work in partnership. So a lot is happening at this more practical level. A theological sharing is obviously a more specialized area. Several universities now have courses in the study of religions, and I agree, I mean, school children seem to have to learn an amazing range of different religions. But anyhow, there is much more, and a few universities now have particular courses on interfaith dialogue. But perhaps more important, there are a number of informal groups. And I belonged for quite a long time to what was called the Manor House Dialogue Group. Manor House is a sort of a Jewish centre in North London. And it was a group of fairly liberally minded clergy and rabbis. And then later, imams joined us. And we would meet perhaps twice a year, usually residentially, at least for one night, because that's so good at building up real personal relationships. And as we built up trust, we found we really could share our deepest convictions. And I'm thinking back, probably some of the times when I spoke most fully about my real faith in Jesus and how he had changed my life. And one could hear some of our Jewish friends talking about the continuing pain of the Holocaust, but also speaking of their deep reverence for Jesus. And I remember one rabbi telling how he often, when he lived next to a United Reform minister in Golders Green. Every Saturday, the rabbi would set out for the Golders Green synagogue. Every Sunday, his neighbor would set out for church. And he asked us, were they doing the same thing? And was the one God who was listening to both of them? But that sort of real reflection which you can have when you have that relationship of trust. But there was also incidental learning. At one of the first meetings in midwinter at a retreat center deep in the countryside, the then Bishop of Oxford organized a walk along the Ridgeway. And of course it was time of year when it was at its muddiest. The rabbis only had city shoes, because the rabbis on the whole are city animals, you see what I mean? And those sort of things which you don't really learn about people until you get to know and spend time with them. And perhaps one of the most moving occasions, which perhaps more theological sharing, personal sharing, was when I visited Hiroshima, and I was shown, I mean, I really rather dreaded going there because there were such memories of one read about and heard about. And I was shown round the Peace Park by a Buddhist who was a child of six at the time the bomb dropped. And I learned something of her agony as she talked of a blinding light and of trying to make her way back to her home, and the home was no longer there, to her parents who were dead. She talked about the radiation, the effects of radiation, her ill health and the many operations, but she spoke without a word of bitterness. And as we came eventually to the peace memorial, we were silent. She was obviously aware of the horrors of the prisoner of war camps the Japanese had run. I was conscious of the devastation of the atomic bomb. But we were aware of a healing beyond those bitter memories. The life-giving spirit, the healing spirit, which renews the faith of the earth and pleads with us to allow the divine compassion to fill our hearts and our lives. There is that moment when somehow we break through our particularities and discover that God-given humanity. And I suppose I've really moved to the fifth dimension, a spiritual sharing. And this has particularly been encouraged by a monastic dialogue. For some time, Buddhist monks have come to stay in Christian theological colleges. Some Christian students have spent a time in perhaps a Zen center or a Buddhist monastery, learning to share at the very deepest level the spiritual life of each other's traditions. And it has been said that religions meet where religions take their source in God. And so as we come together in prayer, we come closer to each other and to the Holy One. Our prayers may be very different, and sometimes there are things which are a problem. Sometimes we just have to listen and respect the difference. But recently, the World Congress of Faiths arranged a 3-day retreat on Journey to Compassion, which was a shared spiritual journey. And so from our different traditions, we were able to share a little bit of how our own spiritual tradition had helped us and helped enrich our lives. And from that sharing, we found so much that we were seeking together. And the World Congress has also arranged physical interfaith pilgrimages to holy places. And I particularly remember going with some Sikhs for 3 or 4 days to visiting their holy places. And finally, the Golden Temple at Amritsar, a great Sikh center. And we got up very early and joined in the morning devotions. And the deep reverence the Sikhs show to their holy scriptures, I think, led me to see just even more clearly what a wonderful gift we have in the Bible. And the way that always when they come to scripture, they bow down, that respect. The traditions are different, but that's perhaps the deepest point. Because if a faith is the very deepest point of your life, if you are to get to know another person, that is where you meet them at that level. And later this year, for some years, the World Congress of Faiths has arranged occasions when people of different faiths come together to pray in the presence of the one Holy One for peace among all people. And this year we are planning at the start of the Olympics an unofficial service, but a service for people of all faiths on the theme, Go for the Golden Rule. Because the Golden Rule is something you can find in 13, 15 or more traditions. And this spiritual meeting, it may seem rather specialized, but I don't think it is a luxury. Because it's really the essential basis for all other interfaith work. It's only as we recognize our interconnectedness with all life that we will find a vision to motivate us. Pictures of the earth taken from space have been called a symbol for our time. Astronauts have spoken of the beauty of the earth, and seen from space, there are no religious or national boundaries. And the mystics who have explored inner space proclaim the same message of unity. The French Jesuit and paleontologist Thierry de Chardin said, I live at the heart of a single, unique element, the center of the universe, and present in each part of it, personal love and power. And some of you will know the work of Jane Goodall and the study of monks in Africa. And she talks about that sense of personal love and cosmic power. She says, "We are moving toward the ultimate destiny of our species, a state of compassion and love." And if we meet there, in that sense of the Spirit and the presence of God, the deepest conversation is silence. We've moved beyond words to find our oneness before our one Redeemer and Maker. A day when true worshippers will worship God in spirit and in truth. And each of us, by whom we speak to and by what we say, can in our own small way be part of that movement for wholeness and for unity and for peace. Amen.